Hello everyone, and welcome to the Slightly Foxed podcast, brought to you from the Slightly Foxed offices here in London. My name is Rosie Goldsmith, your very happy host, and happy for so many reasons. Spring has sprung, the trees and hedgerows and flower pots are blooming. I might just burst into song, but we'll see, maybe later. And I'm really happy because we have such a fascinating, topical and important subject on today's podcast, farming. Also happy because of my inspirational guests around the table with me. Sarah Langford, welcome to you. Sarah is the author of Rooted, How Regenerative Farming Can Change the World. Welcome to you, Sarah.
Thank you very much for having me.
Really great to have you. We're also joined by Slightly Foxed editors and publishers Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. Now, Hazel, I know that you're a city dweller, so I'm not going to ask this question of you, but Gail, you do have a country connection.
Yes, I do. I was brought up in a village in Hampshire, and I now live on Dartmoor, surrounded by sheep and pigs and orchards and vegetables, and it's a very rural landscape with a lot of very rural things going on in it.
Mm-hmm. You're not a farmer, though,
Not Gail. A farmer, but we do have about 90 sheep on our land. And we've had, last autumn, we had 6 pigs, one of which is now in our freezer. We have an orchard full of cider apples, and I have my vegetable beds, which I'm passionate about.
I mean, I'd say that counts.
I would say you're a farmer. What is a farmer, Sarah?
I mean, it depends who's, you know, asking the question. Yes. And answering it. I mean, that's a lot of sheep.
Yes, then they don't belong to me. They belong to Bill and Jenny, the shepherds. So yes, there's lots of wildlife and lots of domestic
Perfect.
Animals floating around.
Well, we may just have to ask you a few questions in this podcast as well as Sarah. Now, Hazel, have you ever visited the countryside?
Oh, how insulting. Yes, I did grow up in the country. I grew up in deepest Devon on the edge of a cliff. And it was a very rural childhood. But then I left to go to London and sort of slightly lost touch with my roots. And then I met my husband, who introduced me to East Anglia. And I've just always been sort of in love with East Anglia ever since. And I think I'm probably one of those rather irritating townspeople, you know, who sort of dreams about the countryside in a rather nostalgic way and talks about going back to it, but probably never will because it's too complicated. But I do have those roots.
It's so interesting how often we've already used that word roots.
I noticed that.
And that's the title of your book, Sarah.
It is.
Excellent. Yeah. Good title. Very good. So we've got a good foundation for this podcast, I think, on farming. I live in Wiltshire. I grew up in Cornwall. But before we get on to farming, tell us what's been going on with Slightly Foxed. This is a big year, we know that, the 20th anniversary.
It's our 20th anniversary year.
Gail,
yes.
Tell me what's going on.
Well, we had a fantastic party in February, to which lots of contributors and printers and shareholders and
Lots of writers
came, and we had a lovely time. And in March we ran a bookshop competition for the best window display. And we've also awarded the first biography prize. And now we are just about to publish the third volume in Adrian Bell's Countryman's Notebook series on summer. That comes out on the 1st of May. And it's full of delightful things.
Excellent. Hazel, over to you. What news have you got from the Slightly Foxed offices?
Our summer issue is at the printers. And we're planning our autumn issue.
Yes, but the summer issue is full of far-flung places.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, that we can all travel. But what strikes me about Slightly Foxed, actually, is how many books about the countryside and nature you publish. Mm. And I've actually, just for the short time I've been working with you, I've read much more about the countryside. I've even discovered a Wiltshire farmer called A.G. Street, who was a broadcaster.
Farmer's Glory.
And I wouldn't have known that.
He was very well known in his day, yeah. And actually, Farmer's Glory is still in print with Little Toller.
Wonderful. Anyway, lots more books to recommend later in the podcast as well. And we'll hear more from Gail and Hazel too. Now, Sarah, over to you and me for a bit. We're hogging the limelight for a short time at least. Now, you are also a city dweller and a farmer. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the tug? I mean, you probably know this quote from Goethe. I studied German, so it pops up occasionally. Two souls are housed within your chest. Are they for you, the farmer and the sooty dweller? Do they wrestle for mastery?
Gosh, I love that. I've never heard that.
Yeah.
That sums it up really nicely. And I think the imagery, even that we've talked about this morning, has all been about roots and a yearning. And the one that I write about in Rooted was an accident. It was unexpected. I didn't intend to move to the countryside. Life circumstances took us there, and I'd been in the city for 10 years. And
you were a lawyer,
a barrister. Yeah, I was a criminal barrister and a family barrister. So I travelled around to kind of different courts all over the country, but I lived in London, and my life and daily existence was very urban. Although I guess I did have a rural background, and I think this is what I want to give to my kids as well, and they have it, and I think it's probably the greatest gift one can give a child, is this blueprint of a rural existence, a rural childhood, where you're allowed to be unwatched for long periods, and you're not allowed to be unwatched in a city. People watch you all the time. And that independence and that ability, I suppose, to develop a relationship with the natural world, which you absolutely do as a child, not least because it's on your eye level, is something that I had, because my grandparents were farmers. My dad was a land agent. Lots of our childhood friends were farmers. So I think that's a part of that, that if you are privileged enough to have that, you don't ever lose it. You may forget it, but it's sort of part of your soul, I guess, hence the two souls living in the same heart.
Now, a series of events led to you taking over a farm in Suffolk. Mm. How did the journey from the city to the farm, in this case in Suffolk, how did that happen for you, Sarah?
Well, an accident, I guess. I didn't plan it. I had no five-year plan. Never had a five-year plan, which has worked out all right so far. But we had been going from London to Suffolk for a long time because my husband, he was an MP for Ipswich. So we were going up and down. He was also born in Suffolk, so we had lots of kind of connections there. And then in 2017, he lost his job. I was in the middle of writing my first book. We had an eight-month-old and a two-year-old. And it's a weird thing. I mean, it's a very weird thing being married to a politician, obviously, but it's even weirder when you lose your job as a politician because you sort of have 6 weeks and then you're out and you have to redesign your life. And so we said, let's get out of London, move to Suffolk full time. We were renting a cottage which was on the edge of a field which belonged to his parents. And so the house that he grew up in was kind of two fields away from that. So they had, over time, bought up bits of pasture as and when they came up. So there was about 50 acres of pasture in between us and them. And then shortly after that whole life change, Ben's father, who had long-held ambitions to be a farmer, had finally realised it at the age of 82 and had bought 180 acres of arable, less than a five-minute drive down the road. And so we found ourselves there full-time and with two very small kids and ostensibly unemployed, and thought, what do we do now? And so with the kind of confidence that comes of complete ignorance, said, why don't we take this on? Because the arable was relatively new. The pasture, no one had really done much with it. And then tripped and fell down this sort of learning rabbit hole. And I think actually in reflection, and I guess this plays into the title a bit as well, it also, I think, was potentially driven by a need to do something really real and something very tangible and something that felt quite permanent. And that's the funny thing about this kind of landscape change, is that it's impossible to do something like replant a hedge. We've done a lot of that down old Bronze Age hedgerow lines, and not to feel both your connection with all the people that originally had planted that hedge, laid that hedge, maintained it, and the people that will come after you. who will probably never know that it was you that made the decision to put the hedge in, and you'll probably won't get to see it. Well, I hopefully will get to see it in its fullness, but there is a lot of that in farming which is quite humbling and really makes you very aware of how tiny and insignificant you are in the grand scheme of things, which I think was probably what we needed to feel at that particular time.
You started in 2017, yeah. Is that right? And that's when you went back and started this journey. The book is very honest about all the obstacles you had and what you had to learn. And you're very generous towards so many people who you've included in the book, other farmers you learned from, other people you learned from. Mm. It was quite a difficult, long learning process, wasn't it? And learning by doing.
Well, I don't know that I can claim that, in the sense that I have a contractor and a grazier. I have done my 3-day tractor driving course. They're not going to let me on their tractor anytime soon, I fear. But I've just done a graduate diploma in agriculture at Science Esther. Went to pick up my diploma. but I make the decisions, I guess, about what's grown, how we grow it. I do all the paperwork and walk the fields every week to work out how it's going and what we need to do next. But I'm not the one on the cultivator. Although we are going to get our own sheep, I hope, this year. So I am going to go to market.
Gail's
soon.
Got a few. She can yes. She can lend you.
Good luck. Yes.
Gail, when you hear that, is this something that would ever have appealed to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if I had my time over, I think I would love to be a smallholder. But anyhow.
Hazel?
Your book did inspire me, actually, just to think, you know, we do have this quite small garden, really. But, you know, there's a bit of a derelict pond at the moment and things like that. You know, it sort of inspired me, really, to think what we could do that would be constructive with this garden. So
absolutely. We all mean this. We all love your book. It's yes, really inspired all of us.
Gosh, thank you.
I mean, let's talk a little bit more about it, because you, the title that is rooted, as we say, and then the subtitle, How Regenerative Farming Can Change the World. I mean, this is a big...
Punch, it's true. Yeah.
I'd buy it for that reason. But it's about revolution. It's about major change. And you actually use the word revolution in your book. So what is regenerative farming?
Well, you can get extremely complicated about it, and some people do, about the various principles it stands on, like keeping roots in the ground, keeping the soil covered, having a diversity of plants and animals rather than just one single variety, integrating livestock. But I've got a farmer friend called George Young, and I mean, I think he puts it the best way, which is ostensibly you're putting more into your land than you're taking out, and you're thereby regenerating it. And that's kind of across the whole spectrum of categories. So if you measure everything at the beginning of your rotation, we, for example, have 5-year rotations, so we grow something different every year for 5 years. Probably likely to make that 6 years quite soon. And at the end of that, if you measure everything and you've got more, but you have still produced food off that land, then you're regeneratively farming. So that would be, you know, more insects, more birds, more pollinators, more carbon in the soil, more water holding capacity, more of everything.
It makes so much sense. There are so many short readings I've found in your book. I've marked them up in the book. And you said you'd kindly read a little bit from
your own
book,
yeah,
which would be great. I think we'd all enjoy that. There we are. Lovely.
So this is from the story of Ollie, who's one of the farmers that taught me really what it meant to farm in this way. And yeah, this is from his chapter. Regenerative farming is not problem-free. There is always a compromise or a lesson waiting. It is a labour-heavy system in an industry that is mostly mechanised. Some say regenerative farming can do more than produce food. They say it can restore insect populations that are so in decline that studies have warned nearly half could die out completely in the coming decades, and in turn restore the population of birds and other creatures that feed on them, whose numbers have crashed without the food and habitat they rely on. They say that the way animals are grazed in this system does not just enable plants to survive droughts and floods, but ensures carbon is locked up as organic matter, cooling the planet in the process.
that it increases soil biology, damaged from overuse of artificial nitrogen, pesticides and deep ploughing, which in turn has led to erosion, soil loss and water and air pollution. That keeping living roots in the ground all year long helps to keep rain within the fields rather than allowing it to wash off and flood the villages downstream. They say that in winter, where other farmers' land is boggy and poached and the roads are streaming brown with soil runoff, you can walk the length of a regenerative field without picking up mud on your boots and watch as the drains run clear and clean. None of this is mythical. I say that because I've done that.
I do want to ask you how you as a woman have been viewed by other farmers, because, you know, it's not the traditional route for women.
You were very brave with Uncle Charlie.
Yes.
There are various incidences in the book where I think, oh, goodness, this could go bad.
So did I.
How are you treated as a woman, as a female farmer?
I think that having 10 years of being in the criminal court system was quite good training, because the criminal bar is pretty male heavy and there's some pretty big egos. Basically, the criminal bar is what you do if you like dressing up and showing off and the sound of your own voice. And I, you know, firmly put myself in that category, but that does tend to attract a certain kind of guy. And so that was quite good background training for it. And there's a funny thing that happens in farming, and I saw it all the time. I write about it a little bit, but there seems to be a split between livestock farming, so animal farming, and arable farming. So women do the animals because presumably they're supposed to care more, and men do the arable farming. In those farming couples, every single farmer's wife I've ever met, and I write about this a bit, still is massively involved in almost every single area of the farm, including mostly, they're usually the ones who do all the paperwork, and they're usually the ones who actually are all over the figures.
Well, Helen Rebanks and her wonderful book, The Farmer's Wife, that comes through very clearly indeed.
Because I was interested, Hazel, you said something about country books. These people who had endless time just to walk about observing and writing, somehow yours was so human. That's one of the things I enjoyed about it so much.
It's the stories of the individuals. Yes. I mean, can you tell us a bit about some of the farmers who feature? Because, you know, I can't remember which one it was, but who goes through the whole process of realising, you know, what's been done to the land and finds out for himself.
They all sort of do that to an extent, with the exception of Charlie, my uncle, who is the first chapter, but who actually really was one of the reasons why I wanted to write in the first place. So Charlie Flint, who is my uncle, my mother's youngest brother, and was a big part of our life growing up because we were on my grandparents' farm almost all the time, lived there for 6 months, went there for most of the summer holidays, pretty much every weekend. And he had a column in Farmers Weekly for 25 years called Flint on Friday, which is a great tradition in farming. And I hope we talk about this as well, this kind of legacy of farmer writers and the sort of creativity that is inherent in farming, whether that's kind of Claire Layton's woodcuts or and we've mentioned, I think maybe we were talking about it before, AJ Street, who of course also had a column in Farmers Weekly.
Yes.
And that's what propelled him into, well, was one of the exposures that he had into writing. And then Adrian Bell, who has this canon of writing all in Suffolk.
Yes.
And you reissue him?
We reissued the first volume, Corduroy, in his trilogy. When he goes off as an apprentice in 1920 to a farm in Suffolk. And Corduroy covers his first year, and he has literally come. I mean, he's fleeing an office life. And it is the most magical description of a farming year. And it's fascinating because they are on the cusp of change. So the farmers have been incredibly prosperous as a result of having to produce as much food as possible during the First World War. And the recession, the slump, the depression is you know, not far off the horizon. And he then, in his second book, Silver Lay, and third, which is called The Cherry Orchard, charts through the 30s, the decline in farm workers, the mechanisation, cottages tumbling down, terrible stories of, you know, farmers having to sell everything. And you go through the whole cycle. And then Adrian Bell himself during the war farmed and wrote about it up in Westmorland. It's called Apple Acre, I think. But after the war, he became a columnist on the Eastern Daily News for every Saturday for 30 years, produced a Countryman's Notebooks, which we're reissuing. And in those articles, which are drawn from all three decades, he reflects a lot on what he sees in happening in the fields around him in an area that he knows incredibly well. And, you know, I don't think he would have wanted to go back to the past in toto, but he certainly could see that damage was being done to the countryside and that traditional farming ways that had been given up in, you know, mechanisation and artificial fertilisers and all the rest of it were damaging.
Gail, that's a fantastic description.
Talking about Adrian Bell, a quote that stood out for me was, he says, in one of these little pieces he wrote for the Eastern Daily Press, he says, "I now have care of this soil which former men have cherished. I feel such a compulsion to it. It's the most important thing in life to me."
Gosh.
So he was very into that, wasn't he?
Gail and Hazel, thank you so much for that. And Sarah, I just want to ask, you write a lot about the history of farming as well in this book, and what we've been talking about with Adrian Bell and what he went through. There's so much reflected in this as well. So you're obviously fascinated by that, by the roots of it all. What are some of the other books and inspirations for you?
Well, in terms of kind of contemporary books that have inspired, because there is a farming boom in writing anyway, I think Isabella Trees Wilding was really transformational just because its ecological knowledge is so interesting. I write, in fact, in Rooted about the first time I understand that when a tree has a low-hanging branch that reaches the ground, which previously we would have cut off, it's like an old man putting a walking stick down. It's doing it to support itself. And then, you know, I see the cows rubbing themselves up against and eating all the leaves off it, and I think, why on earth would you have cut that off, you know? But, and I've got a very good friend who's a vet, and she had a light bulb moment with Wilding because it was the first time she understood that we had dung beetles in the UK, mm-hmm. and that all the medicine that she was prescribing was killing them. And so that was a really important book for changing the way that you see. And I think that's kind of partly what I mean by the subtitle as well, is that once you start to see the connections and your own connection with everything around you, it's very hard to look at it the same way again. So, and then obviously the Rebankses, prolific.
James and Helen.
Yeah, who I know well. You know, English Pastoral had not come out when I proposed this book. So when English Pastoral came out, a lot of the things it talks about are very aligned with what's in Rooted. He obviously is farming in a very different part of the world, but the fact that he also has this sort of legacy within his own family, as I do within mine, of the last three generations of change.
There's so much in the book to talk about. And the other person I want to talk about is Eve Balfour as well. Obviously a major inspiration to you and to all of us. And if we're talking about soil, which you've already, you know, mentioned, of course,
yeah.
and organic farming and climate change and so on. I mean, Eve Balfour was there before any of this really was Sarah, well known.
Yes, Sarah's written a lovely article about Eve Balfour's book, The Living Soil, which was groundbreaking. Sarah, tell us about it.
It was. Well, she wasn't doing it alone. There was a cohort of people in the 1930s, early 1940s, who were all interested in this. And there was a sort of split of thinking between where the solutions lay. Albert Howard also wrote a book called Agricultural Testament, published almost exactly the same time as Eve Balfour's The Living Soil. And there were other people in America and so on. So that's why the Soil Association, she co-founded the Soil Association with various other people. And that came about because of the reaction she got globally from The Living Soil when it was published. It is not the most interesting book to read. It's quite dry. But in this funny kind of twist that ties in a bit with what we were saying about this world of farming somehow also generating lots of writers, she had a sideline in crime fiction writing, which she did with her partner, her female partner. She had two very long-term female partners, and she did it to get herself through the depression, her diversification. Mm. And so she wrote a book called The Paper Chase, which was got its name because she rode so fast on her motorbike that all of the manuscript flew out of the back. And then she had to spend an hour sort of picking it out of hedges. And that was also a global bestseller. And so she must have been good at writing crime fiction.
Not published by Slightly Fox.
Slightly Fox. But no, to go back to what Eve Balfour did, she measured organic farming versus intensive farming. Yeah. And, well, you know more about this than I do, Sarah.
It was extraordinary, actually, given the resources at the time. And she was a self-taught scientist. She'd gone to agricultural college. She's one of the first women to be sent to agricultural college at her request, even though she was from a very smart family. They were very kind of permissive with her ambitions. And she took 3 farms, which is important. So you're not just doing a strip in a field. You're doing a whole farm scale experiment, which is really unusual. She did one with no artificial inputs at all, one with artificial inputs and animals, and then one with artificial inputs and no animals. And then she found this biochemist to take a soil sample from every single field every month for 25 years, which is not something that we even do now, and measure it for an enormous array of what they could find. And she basically concluded that soil is alive, that during the growing season, there will be up to 10 times more phosphate, for example, than there will be during the dormant season, even if you haven't done anything to the soil, that it changes itself depending on what is growing and it needs. And now we know more, much, much more, although, like it's always the case, the more you know, the more you realise you don't know.
Now, we've spoken primarily about the positives of farming, but what about the negatives though? I mean, there is more talk about ploughing and the fact that ploughing can destroy the soil, and that farmers are expected to do so much. They're expected to steward the land. They've got a huge responsibility, constantly put upon by government, you know, without their subsidies and so on. I mean, there's an awful lot of negative stuff flying around as well. Agriculture itself contributes to greenhouse gas emissions and so on. I mean, I'm sure you have to answer these questions all the time, but what is your response to those particular negative issues?
The way that we've been farming for the last 70 years has been fatally destructive. You know, we've decimated insect populations, we've decimated bird populations, we've got to a situation where officially no river in England is safe to swim in because of the amount of nitrates washed into them. We've decimated fish and invertebrate populations. And we've also destroyed our soils. We have a very forgiving climate in the UK most of the time, although everyone can look out the window over the last few years and know that it's becoming more extreme when you have an entire year's rainfall in a day, for example. But over the road in France or Spain, they're having real life desertification, and their soils are, I think half of Spain is now at risk of becoming desert. In my opinion, one of the only silver linings of Brexit was that we broke from the Common Agricultural Payment Scheme.
Which provided subsidies to farmers.
No, it paid you money for owning land, which is a very different thing. And so if you owned land, you got money for it. And a third of all farmers are tenants, so they didn't get it. And now we are being paid public money for public good. So that means that the UK is the only country in the world that I know of where the government is paying you to farm in a way which is essentially regenerative. So some of the stuff I write about in Rooted, like agroforestry, where you plant trees in the middle of a field and farm in between the trees, I mean, it was so far out there when I was writing about it that I describe a very explosive reaction from the person I'm talking to for even saying the word agroforestry. Now it's one of the sustainable farming incentive options that's coming out. Hazel.
Well, one thing that seemed to come across to me from your book was that sort of small is beautiful, you know what I mean? Mm. And what I haven't quite worked out is, you know, can this be done on scale? What you're suggesting?
I think previously it was very hard to do it on a scale. And I think the change now has been in the connectivity that people have and their ability to team up together. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you've got quite a small farm, 250-acre farm, which is tiny compared to most places in the world, you've got no real power. Mm-hmm. But if you team up with all of your neighbours, for example, to get a grower contract or to get biodiversity net gain payments or carbon payments, and you're talking really now about 4,000 hectares, then you can tap into it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I completely understand the argument that small is really difficult to commercialise. And when you're talking about big supermarket contracts, because of the requirements that they ask, it's really hard. But I think farmers have been squeezed on every single margin. That combined with the fact that you can direct sell, because the internet has made it really easy to, you can get a little machine and take payment from a card in the middle of a field, even if you've got connectivity, that has changed the playing field enormously. So I think, like all of these tipping points, we are definitely at a tipping point where we cannot keep going as we are, we can't keep going financially, and we can't keep going ecologically. And then new technology has enabled us to connect with one another and really team up and boost our ability to be players in big contracts.
Because one of the things, you know, you hear constantly about farming nurture today is that it's so lonely. So I imagine that, you know, this also opens up all sorts of possibilities of that kind.
You're completely right. I was talking to a farmer last week who farms by himself 1,000 acres. So he is basically on a tractor the whole time. And I've just persuaded him to join our cluster. And he's going to come to our next meeting, which has got, I think, 70 people signed up. So that side of it, the sharing of resources, the sharing of equipment, the sharing of enterprises, is really extraordinarily beneficial in a way that's quite hard to put on paper. It's quite hard to put on a leaflet, you know, come and have a drink with us. And the other part of that, which is something that I've been talking about with a large organisation that I probably shouldn't name in case they don't do it, but I hope they will, is to pay farmers for access. Mm-hmm. So to pay farmers to allow the public on their land when they don't have public footpaths. And there is an increased interest into something that, again, I thought was so wild no one would ever do it, and now they are, which is green prescribing. So GPs saying, rather than have an antidepressant, I'm going to give you membership to the national parks or whatever it might be. And so that's going to bring that connection between landowner and person again.
Sarah, I mean, you're a riveting speaker. I think you could change the world.
Oh, that's quite a high bar.
Yeah, but you're doing your bit, and it's wonderful to listen to, isn't it,
Gail?
Yes,
it's very exciting because really, it has so many sort of elements to it, doesn't it?
It's life. Movement. It's all human life. It's everything is there. I mean, this has obviously changed your life a lot. And I know you're writing another book now, which is this part two of your story, your farming story? Or what is your second book? Your third book, actually, because your first book was about the law.
It was.
And then this book, Rooted. And what's your next book?
I'm going to keep that under my hat for now because I have been writing the proposal for the last 4 months and I haven't actually sold it to my editor, although we are working hard on that.
Is it connected to farming?
Yeah, it's connected to the ecological side of it, yes. It's the same idea. So being outside a system and not really knowing it, but understanding that system touches your lives, touches all our lives every single day. Mm. And I really wanted deliberately to put people in who had just got to a place where they just went and did it. They just made enormous changes to their farm, but also to themselves and their family and so on, to show that you don't have to be necessarily, you don't have to have a kind of profile or a platform to do this.
They're great stories too. Well, just to finish this part of the podcast, there is a final reading, which is pretty much the end of the book anyway. And I love this. I think it's a really thoughtful ending.
Finally, I came to understand that even if the 83% of our population who live in urban areas do not know it or feel it, all of us are connected to our farmers, and them to us. They may represent just 1% of our workforce, but they look after 70% of our land. Their choices affect us all. whether we have clean air, clean water, rich wildlife, healthy soils in which to grow nutrient-rich food, habitats for the food chain we are part of, or whether our soils have the ability to store a pool of carbon three times larger than that which is in the atmosphere, amounts so vast it has the potential to cool our planet. Many have held on to a connection we have lost with the natural world. As we navigate a lonely online future, some have learned lessons about life even those who will never step foot in a field may find valuable. Farmers can do this. We just need to enable them. They carry both our country's future and its history in their hands. And in doing so, they carry ours too.
Well, I think I'll be following you in your revolution. I'm sure that Gail and Hazel will as well. Anyway, for the time being, thank you everyone for that. It was a really great discussion. Thank you, Sarah, so much. To be continued, though, after this short break, when we return with our unmissable book recommendations. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere. It champions the lost, lesser known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists, or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website, foxedquarterly.com. Now, if you prefer to speak to a human being, then do phone the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Fox family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and this podcast. We'd love you to join the Slightly Foxed family. Now, a reminder, if we need one, that this is a books podcast and we're here to talk about books and, ta-da, the much-loved Slightly Foxed recommended reads. Gail and Hazel, what have you got for us this time? Hazel, you first.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, we've talked about Adrian Bell, who I do recommend. I think we've probably said enough about him to kind of ring the bell for him. But I also went back to my shelves after reading this, somehow thinking, you know, what else have I read that sort of chimes with this? And I have got all the books by George Jewett Evans, who was writing mainly about East Anglia in the sort of 50s, 60s and 70s. And he was an oral historian, really, and he does get into some pretty sort of esoteric stuff with, you know, old horsemen and old customs and beliefs. But I looked at all the books I've got, which are, you know, they have titles like The Pattern Under the Plough, The Days That We Have Seen, Ask the Fellows Who Cut the Hay, you know, which do sort of ring a particular note, don't they? But the one that I particularly enjoyed, actually, is called From Mouths of Men, which is interviews with people who were probably born at the end of Victoria's reign and were growing up in the first half of the century. Servants who worked in big houses, horsemen who, you know, saw their livings disappearing with the advent of the car. There was a fascinating bit that I lighted on someone who'd worked in a great house in Suffolk and had been grimly treated. I mean, it was a sort of totally grim life if you were a sort of under housemaid, you know. And then she made it to London and worked for members of the Bloomsbury Group, and that was incredibly jolly because, you know, they all treated her like an equal, and they seemed so much nicer than I'd ever imagined them. So I just found it, you know, it was just a sort of wonderful recreation for someone who does suffer a sort of rural nostalgia. Certainly they're very gripping. So that's my sort of recommendation.
Well, thank you very, very much for that. Another one to add to my list. Sarah, have you read that?
No, any of those? I mean, obviously, Ask the Fellows Who Cut the Hay. and Pattern Under the Plough, but I hadn't heard of that one. That sounds really...
Yes, it is. Yeah. And he gets the sort of timbre of their voices so well, and is obviously just terribly gripped by their stories.
Maybe we should reissue it.
Yes. It's not a sort of continuous story, but it's a lot of people's stories.
Mm. Gail, what about you? What have you got for us? You've mentioned quite a few books already on this programme, which is wonderful.
Well, Sarah mentioned the wood engraver Claire Layton. I, the other day, discovered that the Bodleian Library have produced an anthology of Claire Layton's wood engravings, and it's called Rural Life. And she produced engravings of rural craftsmen, farmers, woodsmen, and they shire horses, ploughing. They are the most fantastic illustrations. And she then moved to the States and did much the same over there. So for anybody who's visually interested, I would recommend that. But the other book, which is kind of tangentially related to farming, we in my local town had a wonderful hardware shop called Arnold's. And you could go to Arnold's for anything you needed. Potting compost, a sieve, brass screws, pot of paint, matches. And dear Mr. Arnold and his lovely staff always supplied everything that you needed. And he had everything. And very sadly, he retired and nobody wanted to buy the business, and it's now closed, and it's left a huge hole in my life. So for Christmas, my husband gave me a book called Rivets, Trivets and Galvanised Buckets. And it's by a man called Tom Fort, an ex-BBC journalist. And it is all about a hardware shop called Heath and Watkins in Sonning Common, which is just north of Reading, which his daughter-in-law took a lease on some years ago, and she has kept it going and revived it and reinterpreted it, and they now supply lucky residents of this village with all their their ironmongery needs. So he intersperses the story of this shop with the history of hardware, DIY.
Isn't that wonderful? I'm so thrilled to be learning about this.
So lovely. He tells the story of the man who invented the rule plug, who was called James Joseph Rawlings, and he had a science PhD. And in 1910, the British Museum wanted to hang some pictures on plaster walls, heavy pictures, and they asked him if he could come up with a solution. So he went away and did a bit of fiddling about, and he produced the first rule plug, which was jute, roughly the same size as the hole in the wall, and when you put the screw in, it expands and it locks it in tight. And he patented it in 1913, and he died in 1942 in Wimbledon, quite a wealthy man, and the rule plug company is still going. Then there's another story about WD-40, which was discovered by a chemist called Norman Lawson in America, I think somewhere on the West Coast, and he devised a lubricant for the aeronautical industry, and it could basically reach the parts that 3-in-1 couldn't reach. So he did that, and then some years later, a very similarly named man called Norman Larson devised the method by which this liquid was delivered, so that everybody knows what a can of WD-40 looks like, the nozzle that it gets it, it's all about the
absolutely.
Nozzle. So there's that. I could go on. There's the history of the screwdriver.
Gail, jaws are dropping round this table.
But it's such an entertainingly written book. It's all these lovely nuggets of information about stuff that you use. Who invented the plunger for the sink? Who had the genius idea of a stick with a rubber cup on the top that, cleared your sink for you?
The things you learn on a Slightly Fox podcast, who would have thought? This has been such fun.
Sarah. That is everyone's present sorted for the entire year.
I was thinking that. Yes, absolutely.
We have, I can't remember what the name of your hardware shop was.
It was called Arnold's.
So we have an Abbott's.
Yes.
We have a competition to see what they won't have. Mm. And I remember once, in fact, I may write about it, but Ben goes, I've got it. I've got the thing. And for reasons that I can't remember, he was making creme brulee, which is never something that he's done before
this
or
is
since.
Your husband.
Yes. Ben. And he goes in and he says to James in Abbott's, do you have one of those burners that you burn creme brulee with, thinking,
I've won the competition, the family competition.
There's no way he
and
has
James goes, large or small. And it too is, I mean, it's just the nexus of the village. It
it's wonderful. I'm going to have to round this up, unfortunately. It's been such fun, but also very, very informative. So thank you, everyone, so much for being with us today. Sarah Langford with your wonderful book, Rooted. Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as ever, thank you very, very much for having us. That's it from Slightly Foxed for this episode. And that's it from all of us here at Foxed Headquarters in Hoxton Square. I think Gail and Hazel would agree that it's been a real journey of discovery and celebration for all of us. We'll be back in 3 months' time, new season, on July the 15th, when we track down more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, easily accessed on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com, where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and great authors, in reading and rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. Thank you for joining us.